I think the hardest thing for us was leaving Lisa in the hospital. We didn't want to go home and leave him there.
Something needs to be done. It could start with a tougher sentence and give the judges the tools to do the job, get these people off the streets. I just remember Reese as being a really bubbly, lovable lad. He'd just make you laugh.
I just remember Reese smiling. He was always smiling, he was always laughing, always joking around. And he was always his most happiest when he was playing football.
Hi M&Ms, welcome back to another episode of Murder and More. As always, I am your host, Kira. According to the Serious Organised Crime Agency, organised crime related to gangs is focused in larger cities, in places such as London, Manchester, and Liverpool. Gang-related organised crime can also be found across the West Midlands, the South Coast, and generally in Northern England. The Serious Organised Crime Agency reported that London, Birmingham, Manchester, and Liverpool have some of the highest rates of gang-related crime, with gangs accounting for 65% of all firearm murders in England and Wales. In Liverpool, street gangs have been around since the mid-19th century. Reese Milford Jones was born on the 27th of September 1995 to Stephen and Melanie Jones. Reese was the youngest of two, with a brother, Owen, who was 5 years older than him. The family of four lived on the Croxteth Park estate in Liverpool. People felt safe in Croxteth Park. It was a real residential area, with a school, medical centre, some shops and a church located on the estate. Stephen and Melanie Jones had lived there a significant amount of time and had never had any concerns about the area.
We've lived on that estate for 17 years. I've never felt unsafe. It's a lovely area that we live in.
Obviously seeing groups of kids knocking around, but you know, nothing more than what you do as a youngster yourself. You know.
It's a really lovely looking estate. You know, you drive on it and there's trees, there's woods, there's plenty of greenery. All the houses are nice.
By all accounts, Croxteth Park Estate was a well-kept, private, close-knit estate. In August 2007, Reese was just an ordinary 11-year-old boy who'd just finished Broad Square Primary School and was due to start Fazakerley High School in the September. Reese's former head teacher and neighbours of the family report Reese as being a friendly and popular boy who loved playing football. His father described him as the outdoors type, enjoying being anywhere but in the house, and recalled that he considered himself a bit of a joker, always trying to make people laugh. His mum recalled in a later interview that even though Reese was nearly 12, he still loved being tucked up into bed at night and just had endless amounts of energy.
Reese was a very happy and energetic little boy. He was also very funny and just a really outgoing little boy.
He's one of those lads that you couldn't be mad at for very long. And even if you were mad at him, he'd just make you laugh. He's just lovable and likeable.
Reese was blessed with a loving, encouraging, supporting family. His dad, Stephen, worked nights, so the family didn't get to spend much time with him during the week, which just made the weekends together as a family even more special. Reese was extremely passionate about football and was an immensely talented player for the Firtree Boys Football Club. The 22nd of August 2007 was an ordinary, warm, sunny day. The summer holidays were nearly over and children who were preparing to go back to school were making the most of the last few weeks of freedom and sunshine. Reese had football practice once a week and played a match every weekend. The team coach decided to get in another practice before the season began the following Sunday. Rhys had a plan. He'd go to football training, which started at 6 p.m, and then come home, ready to watch England play Germany that evening. He had a light snack, got ready for football training, and walked himself to the football pitch, about a 5 to 7 minute walk from his house. However, when he reached the pitch, he realised he'd left his £5 signing on fee at home. So, Rhys ran the 5 to 7 minute journey back and begged his mum for the money.
This is he watching the TV when he came bursting back through the door because he'd forgotten to sign on the money. Obviously, he wiped his mouth and he just sat on the end of the couch waiting patiently for to give him the money.
Instead of just leaving it and paying next time, he wouldn't. So I gave him his signing on fee. And because he was going to be late, I put him in the car and I drove him the couple of minutes up the road to the training fields.
Football practice finished and he left the pitch at about 7:30 p.m. and began the walk back home unattended. Rhys's football coach offered him a lift home several times, but Rhys insisted on walking it alone. Little did Rhys know, however, that this would be his last ever walk home, and that if he'd have taken his coach's offer of a lift home, this story would have ended so much differently. He'd walked it alone countless times before, to and from football practice. Why should this time be any different? Rhys always took a shortcut to get home, cutting across the Fir Tree pub car park in the middle of the estate he lived on, just a mere 500 yards from his home. With England playing Germany that evening, the pub was packed full of people, ready to sit down with a pint of beer and watch the game. However, despite the bustling pub just metres away, Rhys would never make it out of the car park. Instead, a hooded youth approached Rhys on a silver mountain bike from the opposite direction. As he approached the 11-year-old, the unknown youth pulled out a Smith & Wesson handgun at arm's length and shot at Rhys 3 times. It was later revealed that the bullets Rhys was shot with were the wrong type of bullets for the gun the youth used to kill him. It was initially believed that one of the bullets hit Rhys in the neck. However, at the future trial, the pathologist revealed that the bullet had actually entered his back, just above his left shoulder blade, before exiting through the right side of his neck. Rhys's football coach, Steve, was driving past the Fir Tree pub just as the 11-year-old was shot. He saw Rhys fall to the ground and immediately knew he was injured, but he initially speculated that perhaps Rhys had fallen over and pulled into the car park. However, before he could get his seatbelt off, his son Sean got out of the car and ran to Rhys. A waitress from the pub then rushed out, obviously hearing the gunshots and commotion, and made it to Rhys before Steve. When he reached the scene, she was attempting to give Rhys first aid.
Sean was hysterical. So I'm shouting to Sean, he'll be alright, but I just froze, I was numb, I couldn't have done anything at all. The first thing I done was get my phone out and I phoned the ambulance and the police. And all the time Sean's running around hysterical and I'm trying to say to Sean, he'll be okay, don't worry.
After Steve frantically phoned 999, he then made every effort to find Rhys's home address to inform his parents. He phoned the team's coach, Tony Edge, and instructed him to get to Rhys's house as soon as possible. Bewildered and distressed by the news, Tony ran to the address.
Well, I was just sitting on the settee watching the telly and there was a knock at the door. And I just opened the door and Tony was just standing there.
I said, Steve's just rang me and he said Rhys has been shot, but I don't know how bad it is, that's all I know.
And he just went, you just need to come with me now. And I didn't even have time to think. I just ran into the living room, grabbed my keys and my phone, and I just got in the car.
Well, the distance from Lisa's house to the pub car park was about a minute in the car. We were just really in silence and we were just wanting to get there as soon as possible.
I think I was just in disbelief. I couldn't comprehend what he'd said. I didn't even question what he said. I don't even think I spoke.
When Melanie reached Rhys, he was already unconscious.
It seemed like there was hundreds of people all around. I couldn't see anything at first. I got out the car and I just heard someone shout, here's his mum. And then as I heard that voice, all the people that were together just sort of stood apart, and Rhys was just on the floor. And I just ran over. I could nearly even see where he was hit. I could just see the pool. He was lying in a pool of blood. I just put my hands under his head and I said, come on, Rhys, you're going to be OK, come on. You're going to be OK, I'm here now. It's going to be fine. And people were screaming and, where's the ambulance? And but I was just, come on, Rhys, just look at me, you'll be all right.
Rhys's football coach relayed what had happened to Tony whilst a panicked Melanie phoned Steve, who was on his way to work. Paramedics tried tirelessly for 90 minutes to resuscitate the 11-year-old before taking him to Alderhay Children's Hospital. There, A&E staff persevered. However, their attempts were futile and Rhys never gained consciousness. He was pronounced dead some time later that evening, and heartbroken, Steve and Melanie had to return home without their son. The murder very quickly made the headlines, and the entire country was struck by utter disbelief that such a senseless crime had occurred. The crime also struck fear into the surrounding community, with parents of young children thanking their lucky stars that this didn't happen to their child, but extremely fearful that theirs could be next, with an armed killer on the loose. Streets became so much quieter around the Croxteth Park estate following the murder, with understandably petrified parents keeping their children indoors, not wanting them to be the next victim. A murder inquiry ensued, which would become one of the largest investigations Merseyside Police had ever undertaken. Fairly early on in the investigation, police could tell that this was a gang-related shooting. Less than a mile away from the Croxteth Park estate is the old Croxteth Council estate, and police were already aware that gang activity was rife in the old Croxteth estate. They were also aware that rival gangs operated in the old Croxteth estate and the nearby Norris Green estate, with the conflict increasing over the years to the point where the gangs began using guns.
We were aware of certain things that had gone on in the past, you know, between, you know, Norris Green and Croxteth Crew and stuff like that, but, you know, we'd never been a part of it, we never witnessed any of it. We just never thought that it'd overspill onto, you know, our estate.
The whole scenario of there being gangs on the estate and young boys having guns just seemed a world away from the life that we were living. I just couldn't comprehend it.
I just wanted to understand. I just wanted to know what had gone on, why someone could shoot an 11-year-old boy. Because I knew that Rhys didn't hang around with those type of people. You know, all his mates were, you know, just good lads.
Rhys's parents knew that he didn't hang around with anyone involved in gangs, so were completely bewildered as to why anyone would want to shoot him. On the 23rd of August, 2007, just the day after their baby was killed, Rhys's parents made an emotional public appeal, begging for any information that would lead police to the person that denied Rhys a future.
Someone knows who's done it. And I know people must be frightened, but they've got to think that they can't leave this killer out there. It could be their son, could be their brother next time, because it'll happen again. If he's not caught, it'll happen again.
Witnesses quickly came forward and told police that they saw a teenage boy riding a bike in the car park at the time Rhys was shot. Even though plenty of people saw the gunman, no one was able to identify them. It was now down to police to figure out which gang or gangs were involved in this crime and get justice for Rhys and his family. They obtained the CCTV from the pub, which showed the killer on his bike. However, the youth was hooded, so it was impossible to identify him from these images. Police were starting to piece together a story, however, from details provided by witnesses and the CCTV, and that story proved a tale that's been around for centuries. Rhys was quite simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. You see, it quickly became apparent that Rhys wasn't the intended victim. Of course he wasn't. Who has the motive to kill an 11-year-old boy? Instead, the intended target was Wayne Brady, a leading member of the rival gang based in Norris Green. At the time, Wayne was on his bike across the opposite side of the car park to the shooter. The three shots were meant for him. The first bullet was shot in their direction, and Wayne quickly sped off, and the last two shots were shot as the boys were moving. Unfortunately, Reese was in the middle of the car park at the time this occurred, and one of the bullets unintentionally struck him in the back. The shooter then rode off on his bike as quickly as he'd appeared in the car park and made his way to the old Croxteth estate. In the very early days of the investigation, police already had a suspect. Social media had been rife with speculation about the potential killer, and one teenager's name popped up time and time again, 16-year-old Sean Mercer. And surprisingly, Sean Mercer was already well known to police.
Mercer had a number of previous convictions, only a small amount for relatively minor crime. There was an ASBO in force against him at the time, but he was well known to the local police as being one of the youths who caused trouble, and he was related to the Croxteth crew.
Over the few days after Reese's death, police received plenty of information that pointed Sean as the killer. On the 25th of August, just 3 days after Reese was gunned down in broad daylight, police arrested four teenagers aged between 15 and 19 in relation to the murder. These teens were named as 16-year-old Sean Mercer, 16-year-old Dean Kelly, and 19-year-old James Yates. The 15-year-old wasn't named due to his age. As police believed that Sean was the gunman, they put him in an identification parade, and five witnesses were asked to observe the parade. Unfortunately, none of the witnesses were able to identify Sean as the killer. When Sean was initially questioned, he gave a prepared statement via his lawyer. This stated that at the time of the shooting, Sean was elsewhere with Dean Kelly and another friend. He also informed police in this statement that the two bikes they recovered from his house on the morning he was arrested were the only bikes he owned. However, neither bike matched the bike the gunman was riding. Members of the Croxteth crew gang vouched for Sean, with Dean Kelly providing an alibi for Sean for the shooting. Even though police were fairly confident that Sean was their killer, they had no evidence against him. The witnesses failed to identify Sean in the parade. They didn't have the bike or murder weapon, meaning they had no other choice but to release Sean, Dean, and James. Not only were police fairly confident, but it was widely discussed on the streets and on social media that Sean Mercer was in fact the gunman. Reese's funeral was held on the 6th of September 2007 at Liverpool's Anglican Cathedral, where thousands of mourners attended to pay their respects and say goodbye to the popular, fun-loving and much-loved 11-year-old boy. Meanwhile, police were working tirelessly to locate the murder weapon and the bike in an attempt to link Sean Mercer with the crime. Willing to try anything to identify the killer, police acquired Sean's phone records and found that just before Reese's murder, two phone calls were placed to Sean, one occurring at about 6:40 p.m. Police believed these calls were to inform Sean that the intended victim or victims were in the area. It was later learned that the person who placed this phone call was 24-year-old Malvin Coy. The second phone call was placed by 24-year-old Gary Kays at about 7:10, also alerting him to the fact that members of a rival gang were in the area near the pub car park. They then used Sean's phone records and CCTV from around the area in an attempt to establish a timeline. This revealed that Sean left on his bike at around 6 p.m. and rode to the old Croxteth estate, where several CCTV cameras captured him. They then believe Sean stopped at James Yates' girlfriend's house and that this is where he acquired the gun he would later use. From there, Sean rode his bike to the Fir Tree pub, where he murdered Rhys Jones whilst trying to shoot at his intended victims. After this, Sean rode off to a 15-year-old boy's house, a boy we only know as Boy M. Police believe he rode here because Boy M's house was the closest associate of the gang to the scene of the shooting, but also because he knew Boy M was only 15 and he could assert control over him. Whilst Boy M wasn't officially a member of the Croxteth crew, he had been involved in gang-related incidents. At Boy M's house, police know Sean phones several friends, and they believe that together, the several members of the gang concocted a plan in order to dispose of the gun, the bike, and the clothes he was wearing at the time. James Yates was in attendance at Boy M's house that evening, along with 16-year-old Nathan Quinn. In order to carry out the plan, Sean, James and Nathan drove Melvin's Ford Galaxy just under 2 miles away to an industrial estate where they would dispose of the items used in the shooting. In a lock-up garage Melvin Coy owned, Sean burned his car and cleaned himself thoroughly to get rid of any gunshot residue. Police were able to identify this taking place via CCTV on the industrial estate, which placed Melvin's Ford Galaxy there not long after the murder. As a result of the CCTV, police were able to get and carry out a search warrant. However, all they found in the lockup garage were 3 empty petrol cans. Now that police knew Sean's movements on the evening of the 22nd, they now needed to establish where the murder weapon had been disposed of.
As a result of intelligence that we'd received, a search warrant was executed at the home address of Boy X. In the loft, we recovered a Smith & Wesson revolver, a self-loading pistol, and ammunition that fitted both of those guns.
The type of residue that was recovered by the forensic scientists from the gun matched the residue that was recovered from Reese's football shirt that he was wearing at the time.
With the gun now in police's possession, they were able to confirm that the gunshot residue found on the gun was a perfect match for the gunshot residue found on Reese's football shirt. Finally, they had their murder weapon, leading Boy X to be arrested and interviewed by police. Whilst Boy X wasn't a member of the Croxteth crew gang, he was an associate of Sean's. Boy X recalled to police that that evening, Sean had phoned him, asking him to go to Boy M's house. When Boy X arrived at the house, Sean presented him with a package, which he was instructed to hide. Petrified and feeling intimidated by Sean, Boy X did as he was told, and initially hid it in his garden. The day after Sean, Dean and James were arrested, another associate contacted Boy X and instructed him to hide the package in his loft. As a result of this statement and the crucial evidence he provided, police applied to the CPS for permission to grant Boy X immunity, a route that police very rarely take. With Boy X's witness testimony, the murder weapon, the phone records, and CCTV images, police were finally building a stable case against Sean Mercer and his gang. Now, they needed to find the bike he was riding that evening. Police knew from witness testimony that Sean definitely rode the bike back home after the shooting, but it was from here that they needed to establish where it went next. This pushed police to issue a press release for any information that would lead them to the bike. As a direct result of this appeal, a witness came forward and told police that he was cycling near the industrial estate that evening. As he was cycling, he came across a bike frame and had taken it home with him. A forensic examination was carried out on the frame, which had no wheels by this point, and this revealed the presence of Sean's DNA. Not only had Sean told police that the 2 bikes they recovered from his house when he was first arrested were the only ones he owned, but his mother also stated on several occasions that he didn't own any other bikes. Finally, the police had the bike, the murder weapon, and several witness accounts which all refuted Sean's alibi. In April 2008, the CPS came to a decision and the Attorney General announced that Boy X would in fact receive immunity from prosecution for the testimony he'd given. The police re-interviewed him. The immunity would only stand if he gave truthful information to police. On the 15th of April 2008, Merseyside Police made 14 arrests in relation to the shooting. These people included Sean Mercer, James Yates, Gary Kays, Melvin Coy, Dean Kelly, Nathan Quinn and Boy M. Sean was interviewed shortly after his arrest and gave a prepared statement to once again claim that he had no involvement in the crime and refused to answer any further questions police asked. Gary Kayes and Malvin Coy both completely denied any involvement in assisting Sean after the fact. The rest all refused to answer questions and gave no comment interviews. Alongside the 14 youths arrested, Janet Mercer, Sean's mother, was also arrested for obstruction of justice. James Yates's parents, Marie and Frank, were also arrested as they destroyed a SIM card James was using at the time to contact Sean. Subsequently, Sean Mercer was charged with the murder of 11-year-old Reese Jones, and the rest were charged with assisting an offender, specifically assisting Sean disposing of the evidence. On the 2nd of October 2008, the trial began at Liverpool Crown Court, where Sean Mercer pleaded not guilty to the charge of murder.
Throughout the trial, Mercer and his six associates were in the dock and frequently would be laughing and joking and not listening to what was going on.
And it was an 11-week trial, and it was a terrible ordeal for us to go through and to listen to, and you're scared to let your emotions out because you think if you do, you're never going to stop crying. You're never going to pull yourself together again.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the behaviour of Sean Mercer and all those people in the dock with him at that time was poor, to say the least. This was all done in front of Reese's mum and dad as well. I think that is unforgivable, but I also think it actually shows the type of people that we're dealing with here.
Frequently throughout the trial, Sean and the six associates with him in the dock were witnessed laughing and paying no attention to the trial. It was clear to everyone that they had no regard or remorse for the heinous crime that they had committed. The trial came to an end on the 16th of December 2008 when the jury found Sean Mercer guilty of the murder of Reese Jones and he was sentenced to 22 years in prison. Stephen and Melanie were relieved at the outcome and felt as if they'd got justice for their son.
Mercer showed no remorse at all, even when he was sentenced, very little emotion on his face.
He's destroyed us. He's destroyed our life.
In order to get your head around things, you need somebody to be charged. You need somebody to be found guilty. You've got to have a sentence that you feel reflects the enormity of what they've done.
We got justice for it, because as the sentencing goes, you know, Sean Mercer got the maximum what he could get. And in the eyes of the law, we got justice. But I personally feel life should mean life. He should spend the rest of his life in jail.
These people should realise that, you know, if they're going to go around firing guns and murdering people, then, you know, they should spend the rest of their life in prison.
Additionally, James Yates was sentenced to 12 years for possessing a gun and assisting an offender. Gary Kayes and Malvin Coy were both sentenced to 7 years for assisting an offender, and Dean Kelly was handed a 4-year sentence for possessing a firearm. Nathan Quinn, who was told by the judge at sentencing, quote, "You two went to answer Mercer's call in the aftermath of the killing. Strong evidence you were an active gang member. You continue to deny the offences in the face of the evidence and the jury's verdict. It is folly you are in denial. Your aggression levels are clearly high. You have 9 proven adjudications against you in prison, 6 of them for fighting or assault. There is at least some chance you will learn from your experiences here," end quote, received a 2-year sentence for assisting an offender, and Boy M was given a 2-year supervision order and 4-month curfew. Janet Mercer received a 3-year sentence for assisting an offender. Frank Yates, James's father, was sentenced to 4.5 years for destroying evidence and assisting an offender, and James's mother Marie was sentenced to 18 months for destroying evidence. In October 2009, the Solicitor General made an appeal to the Court of Appeal for James Yates's sentence to be increased, citing her belief that it was too lenient. As a result, his sentence was increased to 12 years imprisonment, proving Sean had no respect for the law. On the 2nd of November 2009, he stabbed another inmate after crafting a knife from a pair of tweezers. As of December 2019, Sean had served half of his 22-year sentence, and the earliest he will be eligible for parole will be in 2030, when he will be 40 years old. Sean has sustained his gang-related activity in prison, with it believed he has now become a prison gang leader in the high-security Frankland Prison in Durham, which is known to house some of Britain's most notorious killers. It's believed that Sean oversees the supply of drugs into the prison, including marijuana and spice. He's also reported to oversee the distribution of alcohol and mobile phones in prison. As a result of Sean's continued gang and drug activity in prison, he was moved from Franklin to Dovegate. However, he was moved back to Franklin just months later after he was caught with an iPhone in his cell. In 2012, James Yates was moved to an open prison where he served the remaining 2 years of his sentence before being placed on a day release programme. He was released from prison in 2015 after serving 5 years of his sentence with the condition that he must not visit the area where Reese was murdered. Not long after he was released, however, James applied to the Ministry of Defence for the exclusion zone to be temporarily lifted so he could visit a family member in the area, not far from Reese's parents' home. Melanie recalls this, quote, "Getting the letter was terrible enough, but to get it 24 hours before such an emotional occasion, Mother's Day, was awful. I'm so upset. I've barely got words to describe how angry I am. I had to come home from work as it was so emotional. How can they be allowed to apply for dropping the exclusion zone? This is the third time this has happened now. The whole system is a farce." End quote. This wasn't the first time an application by a member of the gang had been placed to enter the exclusion zone. In 2014, Melvin Coy was granted access to the area to visit a sick relative. At the end of 2019, Merseyside Police confirmed that James Yates had been recalled back to prison for breaching his licence conditions. Melvin Coy was released on licence in 2011, however was recalled back to prison in 2015 after handling a stolen car that was fitted with a tracking device by police. He was jailed for 12 months for this offence. From behind bars, Gary Kayes was able to father a child with his girlfriend and was granted leave to rush to the hospital when she gave birth. Just a few days after his second child, a baby boy, was born, Gary was released on licence. However, his freedom didn't last long, as he was rearrested in 2013 after police raided his home whilst investigating a huge drugs operation. When the judge sentenced Gary to 3 years and 5 months for conspiring to supply Class A drugs, Mr. Justice Irwin told him, quote, "You have no discipline, no training, no honour. You do not command respect. You may think you do, but that is because you cannot tell the difference between respect and fear." End quote. At sentencing, Judge Irwin told Dean Kelly, quote, "Clearly, under instruction from Mercer, you moved the murder weapon from the dog kennel and hid it in the loft. No doubt you knew all along what had gone on and lent your help with that knowledge. By Sunday 26th, the killing was all over the estate and the country. In the middle of that outcry, you moved the weapon. You are at significant risk of reoffending and causing harm to the public." End quote. Dean served just 15 months of his 4-year sentence due to the time he'd already spent on remand before the trial. However, it would be less than a year before Dean was back behind bars for breaching the terms of his parole. Dean was subsequently arrested while speeding away from police in a stolen car. During this high-speed chase, Dean crashed into a couple's car just seconds after their daughter climbed into the back seat. Dean was sentenced to 10 months for this offence. In April 2019, Dean, who was 27 at the time, was back in trouble with police, this time up in Scotland. East Lothian detectives accused Dean of having links to, quote, acts of violence and intimidation, including the use of weapons, end quote, and accused him of, quote, county lines drug dealing, end quote. He was given an interim ASBO to prohibit him from entering East Lothian, except for court appearances and to meet legal advisers. Boy M, who was 16 at the time of his arrest, has never been named, but is reported to have been diagnosed with ADHD and was allegedly beaten up by other members of the gang for grassing. Following the beating, Boy M became a recluse, and reports suggest that he did not leave the house for 2 years. Nathan Quinn was released from prison in June 2011, and as far as I can tell, he's the only member of the Croxteth Crew gang who hasn't returned to prison since his release. The Rhys Jones Memorial Fund was set up by his parents in Rhys's name to ensure his legacy lived on, and his death wasn't in vain. The charity worked to raise money to build a community centre in the Croxteth Park estate. It's widely believed that gangs occur as a result of children not being kept occupied, which makes community centres a much-needed facility to give teens an interest that doesn't involve violence. Steve and Rhys's football coach, Steve, ran a soccer competition every year for the Fir Tree Football Club where Rhys used to play. Yearly, all the boys that used to play football with Rhys each week gathered together and just had fun during these competitions to keep Rhys's memory alive and raise money for the community centre at the same time. In September of 2013, their 5 years of hard work paid off when they finally raised enough money to fund the building of the Rhys Jones Community Centre built on Croxteth Park, costing £500,000. The Memorial Fund put up half the funds and Liverpool City Council matched that amount. The Rhys Jones Memorial Fund was dissolved in May 2018. The UK doesn't keep records of gang-related crime statistics, however it's highly probable that gang crime has increased significantly in recent decades, especially in larger cities such as London, Manchester and Liverpool. Typically, a gang member will criminally exploit a child into joining the gang. It's believed that organised gangs recruit children because they are more naive and not as suspicious as adults, and also because they will serve a lighter sentence if they're caught committing the crime. Criminal exploitation is a form of child abuse, where the individual is manipulated to commit crimes. A gang member may threaten to harm the child's family if they do not commit the crime. Typically, the child, who may be as young as 12, is forced to move drugs from a large city to a more suburban area, which usually involves trafficking a child away from their home. The NSPCC suggests that children who have been excluded from school, have special educational needs, are suffering neglect, domestic abuse, or sexual abuse at home, have mental health problems, or live in an area where gangs already exist, are more likely to be recruited into a gang. If you live in an area frequented by gangs and your child begins exhibiting symptoms such as frequently being absent from school, staying out late or regularly going missing, being angry, aggressive or violent, becoming isolated or withdrawn or starting to make excessive calls or texts, it may be worth considering if the child is being groomed into joining a gang. If you believe a child is being criminally exploited into joining a gang, talk to them and make them aware of the danger that they are in, but also ensure they feel comfortable talking to you. You can also encourage them to participate in extracurricular activities, such as taking up a sport or a club, to remove them from the gang environment. For more information on criminal exploitation, the signs your child may be being groomed by a gang, and what to do if you are concerned, head over to the NSPCC website. You can also contact them on 0808 800 5000. If you are a child and believe you may be being exploited, please call Childline on 0800 11 11. Never be afraid to speak up. You may just be saving someone's life.
Glistening eyes and cheeky face. angel's halo out of place. You to me are my whole world, wrapped up special in one word. Many hours of giggling fun, you really are a wonder son. Flying freely as a bird, wrapped up special in one word. And you are now asleep at peace, wrapped up in a word that's Reese.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.